This evening is the last Thursday of the month, and our guest speaker for the month of July has been kind enough to be with us for three consecutive weeks. During the first and second week, she covered her story and her personal experience with the first nine steps. This evening, Beth is back with us to wrap it up. And she's done one heck of a job the first 2 weeks, and I'm sure this week will be no different. And maybe, just maybe if we're lucky, she'll share some current experience with amends, which I'm sure she picked up this weekend. And she will share her experience with steps 10, 11, and 12. Let me give you Beth B. from Maplewood.
Hi, my name's Beth. I'm an alcoholic. And I had a really great weekend. I had expectations, and they were not met, thank God. My trip to Florida was kind of felt like a big practice of all 12 steps. It definitely changed my perspective on, I guess, on the world and on people in general. And like what I was talking about either last week or whatever, about how we get scared, we put people in a box so that we don't have to get to know them. We cut ourselves off from learning things from them. And I learned a lot from my family this weekend. My family is not who I thought they were. Like, what an amazing thing. And there's so much more than I ever thought I would want them to be. And that's also an amazing thing. And my grandma's doing good, and she's gonna walk again. The sheer determination in that woman is just, it's awe-inspiring, and I told her so. And I made my amends to her, and I told her that if she needs me, I will be there, and if she wants me, I will be there. And I gave her my medallion, my 10-year medallion, and I told her that when I was 16, they told me that I was not normal. They told me that I would never recover, and they told me that I would never lead a normal life. And that was the plight of an alcoholic. And I proved them wrong. And I had a wonderful life. And I am about as normal as any of you, so you can't really say very much. So, And so, although not the most emotional person, you know, I was sobbing, crying, of course, you know, the blubbering person that I have become. And we shared our moment, and it was amazing. And I see her as a human being now instead of that person up there. Do you know what I mean? Like that grandparent figure that you don't know so well. And she was asking to be reaffirmed. And she was looking for encouragement. And she was looking for somebody to tell her she was doing good. And she was doing good. I mean, I tell you, if I ever have a stroke, I want to be like her. And I told her that too. I said, I want to be like you when I grow up. And I really don't share this very much anymore, but I changed my name when I was 13. Thank you. I changed my name when I was 13 because it was my birthright, and I, you know, using. But I changed my name to Beth because that's her name. And I made myself her namesake. And I told her that I want to be like her when I grow up. If I could have half the strength that woman has, I'm never going to have another problem as long as I live. So it went well, and I was glad to come home. I missed my home. I missed my husband. I missed my cat, in that order. anyway, so 10, 11, and 12. You know, I was thinking a lot about this when I was down there, and, you know, I do a 10 step every night, and am I diligent about it? Yeah, kind of. Am I perfect at it? Not really. But I do it. You know, some people do the written the written thing. They feel the need to write it out. And I've had people call me and say, I need to write it out, and I need to do this. And I'm like, all right, well, you know, then you should definitely do it. I think that everybody does a different kind of 10 step. It's not real like, it's not important how you do it. It's that you're doing it and that I'm doing it. And I think I used to write about it. I used to actually, really cool thing I did a year and a half ago, I bought this me journal. I think it actually said it's all about me on the cover of it. And it had a little stick figure, and I was like all excited about it. And on the inside, it asks you, not exactly the 10-step questions that are, you know, outlined in the book, but it asks you questions like, you know, what did you do today? What did you do for somebody else today? Like, you know, what's something that you would do different tomorrow? I mean, essentially, it was some sober person said, I can't rip the big book off totally, but I'm going to kind of rip it off. And put all these questions in there. And, you know, I would write in it, and I would start to look at things. And now, to be completely honest with you, I do it before I pray at night. I do it in my head. I look at my day, and I say, you know, well, I got in a fight with this person, or I had an argument with this person. Why? Why did I have an argument with this person? And it's become different over time. I can see my motives very clearly today if I choose to. If I choose not to, I got big blinders I put on and I'm like, I was right. But, you know, I had, and this is my brain is the most manipulative thing I've ever seen in the world because this is an actual experience of mine. I had an argument with this person, and I said, all right, I had an argument about this person. Why did I have an argument about this person? Because I brought up something that I know they get angry about. Why did I do that? Because I wanted my distance. Well, why did I want my distance? Because I had ulterior motives of going off and doing my own thing and not taking that person into consideration. This was completely subconscious when I was in the car talking about this subject that makes this person upset. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, this, that, and the next thing. And then they get all mad and we get in an argument. And then I'm totally free to go off and not take them into consideration. This is not something that entered my brain when I was in the car. This is, when I was in the car, I was just like, oh, I totally forgot to tell you. And like brought up the subject. Now, consciously, knowing that this person does not like to talk about this subject, I would not have done it. I believe enough in myself to know that I would not intentionally start a fight with somebody, mostly because I hate confrontation, a self-centered motive, but hey, whatever works. But in looking, I mean, the reason I do my 10th step at night is because I need to look over my actions. I do the spot check. But at night, I need to look over my day and say, where did my disease creep in to screw my life up today? Where did I allow my disease to creep in today to screw up my life? And what am I going to do about it? And inevitably, the next morning I woke up and I said, I'm really sorry I started a fight with you yesterday. I was being an idiot. And, you know, I was really looking to just start a fight. And, it, you know, it has nothing to do with you. And, you know, I'm very grateful that this person, you know, very forgiving of my flaws, of all of my flaws, and we move on. And the relationship is not harmed. Yeah, I started a fight with you. If you choose to hold a grudge about that, good luck. I'm making amends to you in a way that, you know, I started a fight, I'm taking responsibility for my part, and I'm asking you to forgive me with the condition that I will not do this. I will try not to do this again. I will try not to hurt you in this way again. And I'll try to be more conscious of my character defects. And that's the big thing with the 10 step in relationships, which as far as I'm concerned, the 10 step covers all my relationships. Whether it's with a customer that I don't know his last name, or it's with my husband or with my parents or whatever. It's covering my basis. It's keeping me free of resentment so I can continue to be me in this relationship. Because as soon as I cop a resentment, I start to punish you by hiding parts of me that you love. And I start to hide the parts of me that you love so that you can start to see the parts of me that you don't love. And so we can have a nice big fight. and eventually so that I can take my flashlight, shine it in your face, and scare you away. These are the manipulative motives of my disease. Push everybody you love away from you so you can be alone and need alcohol. I mean, although I'm sitting here and completely sober, alcohol is really not a threat. But if I start a fight with this person and I don't clean it up, and I start a fight with that person and I don't clean it up, eventually, if you're smart, which all the people in my life are very smart, you're going to walk away. I'm going to be left alone. I will cause a little drama in my life, a little chaos here and there. And you know what? There's two liquor stores on my block. I'm not close from picking up. So in the 10th step, I'm really trying to make sure I'm cleaning up my relationships on a daily basis. And do I immediately make amends when I'm wrong? Most of the time, yeah. But you know what? Sometimes my ego gets involved and I'm just like, yeah, I know I'm wrong, but I ain't freaking telling them that. And it's, you know, and you know what? The rest, the relationship suffers. And ultimately, most of the time, I'm the only one that knows about it, so I'm the only one suffering. So my 10th step is important. And as far as the spot check, I'm big with the spot check. I worked in a rehab. I was a counselor with adolescents. And let me tell you, you need a spot check when you work with adolescents. Talk about self-centered and selfish and self-seeking motives creeping in when you have the responsibility of an adolescent's life on your hands. My disease wants to screw that up as fast as possible. And I would sometimes get just so frustrated. And I know myself well enough because of my 4th and 5th. I know that when this behavior comes out, this is getting affected. So I go into the bathroom and I'm like, all right, God. I know that the 7th step says take away the difficulties like that I don't need. But if you could just take them all away right now and I could just do my job. And I think that for me, not even just in a therapeutic setting where I'm working with patients, but in any work situation, my character defects flare up. And I know why, but I can't think of it right now because I'm sick. But but I need that spot check. There have been a lot of times. You know, I did a spot check when I was in Florida. We were sitting in the hospital with my grandmother, my two aunts, and my two uncles are there, and we're all sitting there, and we're all, like, being her little cheerleaders, and the therapist is there, you know, moving her leg, and she's working. And I'm very close with my grandfather, who is no longer living. I've always felt he's been around. He's been watching over. He's been there. And, yes, I'm crazy, but that's not why. And he's been there. He's been watching over me. He's brought amazing people into my life. He's helped me to keep these amazing people in my life when I let my addiction step in. And, you know, just an amazing, amazing force in my life. And so I talked to him a lot. And I found myself saying, you chose to leave. You left her here by herself. You better help her. You better help her get better. You better help her walk. And you better make sure that she's feeling good because you chose to leave, and that's not her fault. Now she's all alone, and you better help her. And I kind of took a step back going, yeah, making demands on a dead person. Something can't be right with that. Knowing that what I did was not appropriate, it wasn't right, it was definitely not feeling good in my stomach, but not knowing what to do instead, I just stopped talking to him for that couple of minutes. Well, not a couple of minutes, but most of that afternoon. I said, you know what? We need to put this conversation on hold. I need to call my sponsor. And we got back to my aunt's house, and I called my sponsor, and I said, guess what I did today? And I said, you know, I know it wasn't right, but this is what I said. And I know it's okay for me to ask and talk to him, but I can't find the right words. And isn't that my failing every single time? My motive is good. I want him to get involved. She says, well, why don't you just ask him to get involved and ask him to help her carry out God's will? Because in essence, if you're asking him to get involved, you're asking God to get involved. And I was like, that's what I wanted to say. It's a good thing I didn't start shooting my mouth off even more, because he probably would have gotten pissed off at me or something. And so I asked my sponsor, what do I do instead? And that's really the essence of the 10-step spot check. Had I been in Jersey and, you know, had access to a phone, I probably would have called her right away and said, you know, this is what I'm doing. I know it's not right. It's half wrong. Something's not right. Guide me in the right direction. That's what sponsors are there for. Guide you in the right direction. If you get into a 10-step moment, you know what you're doing doesn't feel good, therefore it can't be very right. What do? Well, obviously I don't have the answers myself, or else I wouldn't be in this mess. Call sponsor. Ask God to get involved. And it really was that simple, and I felt so much better when I got off the phone with her. Then I went about my way, smoked my cigarette, went back in the house, and started cross-stitching again. And, oh, look at that. Free and clear. I put no demands on anybody. The demands I made, I apologized for. And I moved on. Look at that, clean slate. You know, had a little bit of dirt on there, called the sponsor. She helped me sweep it up. She told me what room to use, and I sweeped it up. Swept it up, and now we're clean. And that's basically the 10 step. The 10 step is, you know, yeah, there's an act of the 10 step, but a 10 step is like kind of like 6 and 7, where it's like, you know, we're taking this with us, and we're going to walk with this step in my pocket to pull out anytime I see fit, or forgot to spell in my face anytime he sees fit. Because, you know, have you ever been in one of those situations where just for absolutely no reason you got like this clear thought that says, maybe you should do a spot check. Maybe you should take a break. Maybe you should walk away. And you have the choice to listen to that or not. You can continue your rant and rave all you choose. But that's my idea of God kind of stepping in going, you really don't want to do that. And if you continue to do that, that's another 9-step amend you have to make. And that's my opportunity to say, let's take a break. Somewhere in the book, I think it's in the family afterward, it talks about how to argue. Is that the family afterward? Yes, family afterward. It teaches us how to argue. It tells us that when things are getting too heated and you start saying things that you don't mean, stop. I need to take a break. Can we talk about this later? I'm not rational. Have I rationally said that in an argument with my husband? No, not yet. But I'm going to soon, I hope. Bear with me. Another thing I've been looking at in my 10th step, and it's been on there pretty consistent. First of all, I want to say that any resentment that's on my 10th step for more than 3 days, as a rule from my sponsor, goes straight to a 4th step. If you've got something on your 10th step that's been nagging at you for 3 days, take it to your sponsor. Do the columns. I'm not saying rip out 300 resentments, because no sponsor really wants to sit through that. Rip out the columns, whatever format you do, whatever, 8 columns, 12 columns. Hey, if you got 23 columns, knock yourself out. Put the name down. Put the resentment down. Get rid of it. If it's more than 3 days old, you're wrong. You can guarantee you're wrong. And your sponsor's going to tell you that, and I'm not psychic when I say that. I do get, the other thing about the 10th step is I get angry. I was angry at my best friend, this is a couple weeks ago. She came over and was all excited about something, and she started sharing about it and sharing about it and sharing about it, and I just started getting all insecure about the issue, and I was kind of involved in what she was excited about, and it was kind of, she was, to me it was coming across like she's better than me, so she gets to do these things and I get to just follow behind her. And you know, actually it was because I wasn't getting any credit for the work I was doing is what really what it was all about. So that night I went to bed and I was angry. I have every right to be angry. But what I do with that anger determines whether I'm going to drink or not. So of course I went to bed angry, and I'm sitting there in bed and I'm laying down and I'm thinking about it, and I was very good. I was really, really proud of myself. I didn't yell at her. I gave her a blanket. She was sleeping over. I gave her a blanket. I gave her a pillow. I said, you know what? I'm going to bed. I'm cranky, and I'm going to bed. And I went to bed, and I thought about it. And I came up with the fact that I was feeling less than, which triggers anger, which triggers the flashlight to make you go away now. Stop making me feel bad about myself. And I started to feel like maybe she thinks she's better than me, which my ego got involved. When my ego gets involved, another flashlight comes out, shines it in your face, and it's going to cut you down and make you feel bad about yourself. And I realized that, you know, I'm not getting credit for the work that I'm going to be doing in this situation. I'm not getting credit for it. And I should be. And I was validated inside of myself that that was not okay with me. So it's like, yeah, I'm angry and I got to take responsibility for my part, but at the same time, in that 10th step, I got to validate what's not okay with me. And it's justifiably not okay for Beth to do work and not get credit for it. I'm not saying put Beth on a pedestal and, like, you know, make her the most important person of that day. I'm saying I believe that when work is done, credit is due. And I believe that credit should be given. I work very hard to give credit to all the people in my life that do the things that they do for me. I deserve the same in return. So the next morning I woke up and she was getting ready for work. And I was still a little, like, uncomfortable. Like, I didn't know how to approach it because I knew I had to take responsibility for my part, but there was something I needed to put on the table and tell her. And so I did it. And I didn't yell, and I didn't scream, and I didn't cry, and I didn't make her feel guilty, and I didn't manipulate her. I just told her how, this is what I got from what you told me last night. And she got a little defensive, but at the same time, man, I gotta tell you, this woman, I hope to work a 12-step program like her someday. She's incredible. She put it on the line. Well, that's on you. And I was like, I know it's on me, but I need to tell you. And it was a very, it was the greatest argument and the greatest issue to have put on the table of my entire life, because both of us were valid in what we were saying. And I was very valid in saying, I don't feel comfortable you doing, me doing half of the work and you taking all of the credit. And do you know what I mean? Like leaving me in the background and this, that, and the next thing. And she said, well, I was really just wanted to be excited about something for once. And I'm really getting this opportunity and I'm really excited about it. And she's very valid. And so we decided that this really wasn't a good time to talk and she had to get to work and I had to watch Little House on the Prairie. And, you know, so we went our separate ways. And you know what? She called me when she got to work. And she said, you know what, here's the phone number, why don't you come down for the meeting? They were planning something, and she said, why don't you come down for the meeting, and you can be a part of it. And I apologized, and I said, I'm sorry that I didn't take part in your excitement last night because I was getting involved with my own stuff. And we worked it out. That's all 10 steps. Like, I don't know if she did a 10 step on the way to work, but I can guarantee you she asked God to get involved. And I can guarantee you she looked at her part because she came back with her part and she took responsibility and I took responsibility for my part. And then I validated her excitement and she validated my need for recognition. And you know what? It's gone. The issue is gone. 6 years ago when we met, this would have turned into a 3-day fight. Of screaming and yelling and not talking to each other and having to vent to my friends over here and having to badmouth over here and then ultimately have to make amends for all this crap. Ultimately losing 3 very precious days that I could have spent loving her. All because I got my own stuff over here. So the 10th step is such a lifesaver. It's one of those things, it's like you want to get rid of chaos. You want to get rid of drama, do a 4th and 5th. You want to keep drama and chaos from entering into your life, I do a 10th step. And the biggest thing that I have, especially with people that are close to me, my character defects have been pointed out to me in the last 3 days, and I've been okay with it. But most of the time when the people closest to me point out my character defects, but the fact that when I get in an argument, I like to finger point. Yeah, I do. I'm okay with it now. I'm really gonna try hard not to do that when I get into an argument or into a situation with somebody close to me next time. And in the last couple of days, I've had to look at my behavior as far as expecting other people to do what I do because I do it. So just because you do it, Beth, doesn't mean that everybody else has to do it. Well, why not? If I can do it, anybody can do it. I'm not that brave, and I'm not that smart. Well, yes, you are. And there are things that other people do that I'm incapable of doing. But for some reason, they don't seem to lay the same responsibility on me. So why am I doing it to other people? And I don't want to look at that kind of stuff. I don't want to deal with that kind of stuff. And, you know, now that means I have to change, and we're back to 6 and 7, and it's not easy, but it's worth it. I wouldn't be the person that I am today if I didn't do the work I did yesterday, or this morning, or this afternoon, or this evening before I came here. So I got more work on my plate. I used to think for a really, really, really long time that, well, actually for the first 5 years of my sobriety, I believed that once you got a certain amount of time, you got to this plateau in sobriety. Well, basically nothing really went wrong in your life, and everything's pretty status quo now, and, you know, because you know that uphill climb that you feel? Just when you feel you got to the next level and you're feeling good, it's another freaking set of stairs, and you gotta climb some more stairs, and you just get so tired of climbing stairs. And yet you see people with 15 years, 20 years, 40 years, and their lives seem so normal. They don't have that uphill climb. I do believe that, yes, it is possible over time to create less chaos in your life. Because as we become more accustomed, as I became more accustomed to working these steps in my life, the issues didn't last as long. There are just as many issues in my life today as there were 10 years ago when I got sober. But they don't last as long. So they don't appear as big to other people. And I often wonder, do I look like one of those people now who has this like plateau life? I make it a very big deal to let people know that I still got stuff going on. There's no plateau. I don't want anybody to fall under that stupid superstition that I fell into that, wow, she's got 10 years, she's got her shit together. Because I don't. I don't. I had to tell my husband tonight that I didn't pay a bill, and it's got some pretty serious consequences. And I'm not responsible when it comes to that stuff. And thank God he's an understanding person. And I told him, I said, I really got to tell you, I was going to tell you. I was going to lie. I actually wasn't going to lie because I am the loophole queen. I would just kind of just brush it off to the side and not discuss it, which we all know is lying. And then I was going to take care of it tomorrow. It would be dealt with and he would never know. So my threshold for pain is like nothing at this point in my life. So I, of course, told on myself. And I'm so grateful I picked the right guy to marry, because I don't think anybody would understand me screwing something this big up. And although in 10 years it won't make a big deal, but today it's a big deal. It's an issue. I got it on the table. And he was like, all right, you suck, but, you know. Thanks. He said thank you. He actually said thank you. For what? Just for telling me. And I was like, oh, okay. So I'm really lucky. I forgot what I was talking about. I totally forgot why I started that whole story. Because I probably felt the need to tell myself again. So anyway, that's the 10th step. As far as the 11th step is concerned, I also believe that it's a process. I think that it's something that we should work on as much as possible. I think it says in the big book something like, we should not shy away from this issue of God. Well, yeah, it's kind of a spiritual program. If you're going to shy away from God, maybe you should just leave. If you don't have a higher power, it doesn't work. I don't care what your higher power is. If you feel the need to call your higher power a doorknob, knock yourself out. But without a higher power, this program does not work. And I've gotten told not to say that at meetings. So we shouldn't tell them how to work the program? So we should lie to them and manipulate them until they have no choice. That sounds more like a cult to me. I'm all about putting it on the line. If you don't have a power greater than yourself, your chances of staying sober are 0.01%. You could probably do it. You know, somebody has, I'm sure. But my experience has shown that if you do not have a power greater than yourself, you will drink. Medical books my sister-in-law wrote a paper about the physical. You got to find out more about the physical stuff, about what alcoholism really is. It doesn't start in the brain, apparently. It starts in the liver with the enzymes. So interesting. The medical books will tell you AA is the only thing that is proven to work. A doctor saying spirituality is the only thing that works. So when people come in here, I don't shy away from the God thing. You don't have to call him God. I call him God. If you don't like it, too bad. Get over it. And so, I mean, I tell my sponsors the same thing. You don't like being called a pigeon? Go find another bird to play with. I don't know. Go find another sponsor. Whatever. So, the God thing is so important. My perception of God used to be the group, used to be the Pyramid Club. Because my first experience of how I saw God work in my life was Joe Schmo would piss me off at school. I was a senior in high school. Joe Schmo would piss me off and do something that was very, very obviously wrong to me at school. And I would cop resentment. And I'd be pissed off. Well, I was always pissed off, but I'd be more pissed off. And I would go to the Pyramid Club, and I'd be too arrogant and egotistical to bring up the fact that I'm not perfect. And somebody would bring up the topic of resentment. And the next day at school, somebody would hurt me, or my dog would die. You know, my dog would die, and I would go to the Pyramid Club that night, and the topic would be about dealing with death. God was working in my life. God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. I could not humble myself enough to bring up the topic and say, I'm angry, I'm in pain, I'm not perfect. I couldn't bring these things up in a meeting, so God brought them up for me. That was the first time I saw God work in my life. I mean, you know, other than that little thing of, you know, getting me on a plane and keeping me from drinking all the way from New Mexico. That was nothing. But this was, like, freaky. I was wigged out at one point. At one point, I thought of a I remember doing this. I thought of a topic, and I don't remember what the topic was. I wish I did. But I remember thinking, I told my sponsor about it. I said, Jeannie, this is the topic that I'm thinking of. Let's go see the Pyramid Club. Let's go see if it comes up. And it came up. And I'm sure it was something really, like, broad, like how to stay sober, like the first step or something like that. You know what I mean? But this is God working in my life. And I remember that I really believe my spiritual awakening as far as God coming into my life and me allowing that to follow this came when I got sober. But there are a series of bottoms in sobriety. I firmly believe that your body physically detoxes at 30, 60, 90 days. 6 months, a year, 5 years, 7 years, and 10 years, of which my body's going through right now, and it's not, it's gross. But, and by the way, the research that I read from the paper that I read about the alcohol and how it affects the body, it makes total sense of why it would take 10 years for a body, an alcoholic's body to completely detox the effects of alcohol. The enzymes break down alcohol like something like a quarter of the amount an alcoholic will break down is like the whole amount in a non-alcoholic, so your body detoxes. There are processes of bottoms, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual. There's, you know, my first sponsor used to say, we're onions, peel the layers. You know, she was such a nice person. So we peel the layers. Me, I'm like, chop it up, dice it, saute it. But, so we hit these bottoms, and I remember that first emotional bottom I hit where I spilled all of my abuse issues to my sponsor for the first time. Like, it just came out. And I remember asking God, if you're there, if you exist, if I'm not talking to air, show me a sign. I'm empty. My first sponsor was a big believer in you have to empty yourself out so God can fill you back up. Well, let me tell you something. I emptied out that night stuff that I had never told a soul in my life. Stuff that I tried to ignore ever happened. Told, just spilled it. It was like confession. She might as well have been wearing like a nun's outfit. And the next day I woke up. It was a Sunday. I was on my way. I was going to get up and go to the 10:30 Pyramid Club meeting. And I got up and I walked outside and I saw this butterfly. And I don't know why this butterfly, like, I don't even remember now what this represented, but it just did. And I was flying high. It's that pink cloud, everybody calls it the pink cloud. You know what? I loved it. It was like the best feeling in the world, and everybody's, oh, this too shall pass. Man, hold on to it as long as you can. It's a great feeling, the pink cloud. And I'm starting now to connect, and I'm watching other people go through it. You want to dump some stuff, you get a pink cloud. It's like the payoff. We're such alcoholics, we don't do anything without a payoff. If you dump your stuff, you will get a pink cloud. And it's like such a great payoff. And I remember just flying high, and it was such a great feeling, and God was in me. It was the first time God is in me. So like, this is the perception of God that I come from. He didn't have a face, he didn't have a purpose, he was just there and he felt good and it was a good positive experience. I didn't really have a whole lot of religious of anything in my life. I knew he existed, he was there, he's God, he's there. But he went to Catholic Church, I think that's really what I thought. You know, God, he runs the church, that's his job. But here it was, like this new experience. Do you know what I mean? And it was like, I wish, for as much as I'm grateful for having the amount of time that I have because of the life that I've worked for, I wish I could go back there to just 2 seconds to just feel that again. You know, being a newcomer is probably the worst experience in your life. It sucks. I think it's that way so you don't drink and you have to do it again. It's definitely kept me sober on many occasions. But the payoff are that much greater because those pink clouds are like being in the presence of God. And it's like, it's just incredible. So here I am at the 11th step, praying and meditating to improve my conscious contact with God. I like to meditate, but usually I try to do it when I can't sleep. And when your husband's snoring in the bed next to you, and you hate that, it's not conducive to serenity at all. God forbid I should get up and go into the living room or the other room. I mean, there's plenty of rooms to go into. No, I got to get pissed off. But as far as prayer and meditation, you know, I look at the 11th step and I really see it in my life. I am always on guard for God. I'm always looking for him in my life, in your brother's life, in that guy Joe Schmo's life. You know, I met a woman on the plane on the way to Florida. I sat between an 8-year-old and a Bible thumper. I just kept saying, God, you know, if you could get involved and make them just, you know, disintegrate, that would be great. And I opened my eyes and they're still sitting there and I'm like, you suck. I hate you and I'm not talking to you for the rest of the life. But you know, this woman next to me, she's a Bible thumper because she survived from breast cancer. She was told she was going to die. You have 6 months to live, she was told. That was 7 years ago. And that improves my conscious contact with God. When I see God working in your life, when I sit there and hear about, and you know what, I would never be a Bible thumper because I'm a big book thumper. But, you know, to each his own. And she thought, you know, I told her, I said, my husband's Jewish, she left me alone. But, you know, it's like, I see this woman, and, you know, she does fundraising for a living, and she just, I don't know why people feel the need to tell me their life story in an airport or everywhere I go. I don't know if I have a face like that. I'm sure that I ask for it in some way, because I, you know, like to set myself up for this. But she just told me that the most amazing story on how she was just another Joe Schmo in the world, and then she got breast cancer and just all these miracles that are happening in her life. And now she works for this hospital where she schmoozes with billionaires to get them to give her all their money for whatever the research is. And man, if that's not seeing God work in somebody's life, seeing a Joe Schmo give up their entire life to go get money for somebody else and to be survived, it's like, you know, I haven't met one person in my entire life that has been through a tragic thing and not gotten God. And not become a better human being. The 24-hour book today says we're living on borrowed time, and I remind people of that all the time, mostly because I forget that I should not be here. What am I doing in my life today? What am I doing on this borrowed time that God gave me? Sometimes I turn around and I look myself in the mirror and I get really disgusted and I say, not a whole frickin' lot. Because I'm just like everybody else in this world. I'm a human being. And human beings have the instinct of survival of the fittest. So I, being an alcoholic, must be the fittest and the best. And I'm going to get everything and I don't care who I step on to get it. And then I take a step back and I look at myself in the mirror and I'm like, you're a piece of shit human being who thinks only of herself. Where did you get off? You were given a second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth chance. What are you doing with it? Are you giving to other people? Are you allowing people to see the miracle that's happened in your life? And so that's why speaking is really, really cool for me, is because, I mean, I had a lot of crap back there, and I told my aunt about some of the stuff that was happening to me when I was drinking. I told her about a car accident that I got into on my engagement, the night of my engagement party. I should be dead now just because of that one incident. The tree came down, the car, it was one in a million chance, walked out without a scratch. The car's total. Should be dead. What are you doing with your life? What are you doing to say thank you? And that's what I got to do with the 11th step. It's not only prayer and meditation. It's like, man, talk to people. And it's funny because God has put the right people in your life. You're sitting at the supermarket stand. You see something on this, you know, this person's a schlep sitting next to you. They're waiting in line and they're going price check and nobody comes and you're standing there for 20 minutes. I always take that as a sign of maybe I should take a look around me because I'm not supposed to leave here until I do something, see something, hear something, experience something. And people wind up telling me the most amazing stories. I could fill like 500 hours of sitting here and telling you the amazing things that I've seen God do in my in strangers' lives, complete strangers. I will never see that woman again. I'm actually kind of grateful for that. So it's like, you know, but that stranger gave me more faith. I have a stronger connection with my higher power because I know it's not all about me. I see him working in my life. He brought you into my life so I could see I was working in your life. Everywhere I go. Everywhere I go. I met a stockbroker. Told me to buy stock in the airport. I chose to disregard that one. But I'm sure that the market will go back up now that I did. He said, buy now, buy now. I was like, all right, no. All right, nice meeting you. Bye-bye. But I did also find out that both of the siblings are in AA. I totally forgot about that. Both of the siblings are in AA. That's kind of neat. But anyway, so that is the 12th step. The 12th step says, what does the 12th step say? Damn, 12. Awakening as a result of these steps, through character message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. In all our affairs. Yeah, well, I changed it. Yes, I have taken control of the 12th step, and I have changed it. But my sponsor said so. He said I could. I believe that the 12th step is not just for alcoholics. If I really think that I can only give to the people in these rooms, then I'm just being self-centered to my own kind. It's like saying, you know what, you're not German and you're not Italian, therefore, sorry I can't sponsor you. It just doesn't work for me. I try to be of service to everybody that comes across my path. Practicing these principles in all of my affairs is how I do that. My sponsor calls it, and I have adopted it, leading by example. That is my job in this world. And I will tell you, ask him, you know, what's your name? And, you know, that's 12-step work, leading by example. You're leading by example by doing that to the rest of your group members of how you should treat people that are new to the meeting. I don't know if you guys do that here or not. I'm not making a judgment call at all. It was really just an example. But other things as far as, you know, 12-step calls are great. 12-step calls suck at the same time because it's usually 3 o'clock in the morning and they're still drunk. And I did a 12-step call once where me, I think there were three of us, or four of us all together, wound up putting this girl into a car. She was drunk, so I wouldn't put her in my car. It's when I still had my dream car. And if she puked in it, I would have had to kill her. So this other guy took her and hurt his car, and I met them at the hospital. I followed them with the top down. And she was, like, falling out of the car. And she's like, you know how some people get when they're drunk, where it's like they love you, and then they hate you. And 3 minutes later, they're sorry. And then 3 minutes later, they're leaving. You know, and 3 minutes later, they're groveling. And it's just like, could you at least pick just two emotions and bounce between those two? It's much easier. We know what to expect. We know what's coming. So this is one of those people that just could not hold on to one emotion more than once for more than 3 minutes. And it was really the most horrifying experience of my life, because she's suicidal and she's leaving and she's not an alcoholic and she's a drunk and she's happy and she's glad she's in treatment and she's leaving and she's crazy. And I'm sitting there going, can I go home? I really changed my mind about the 12-step call, and I'd really like to leave. And I felt really uncomfortable. And I, you know, sometimes 12-step calls are just purely, sometimes you just gotta suck it up and do what you gotta do to help another alcoholic, whether you like it or not. And there is no payoff, because she didn't get sober, as far as I know. And, well, for a long time she didn't get sober. Now she's sober. But she's not around me. Yay. You know, and you know, I walked away from that thing thinking, God, I'm not doing any more 12-step calls. I don't care what my sponsor has to say, until she actually says it. And then, you know, I'm just doing my own thing from now on. And if people want to get sober, I'll meet them at meetings. And I'm not working with newcomers anymore, because they lie. And when they open their mouth, just comes out. And it's just, no, thank you. You know, and then there are the 12-step calls where just these miracles happen. And, you know, even if you're not a part of their, like, support group or their sobriety, I've seen so many people that I've seen drunk get sober. It's a miracle. So 12-step calls could go either way. There, you know, when I say we, I mean my sponsorship family. My sponsors, my sisters. We have rules. My spouses and my cousins, and we have the whole thing worked out, and it's very well mapped out. We have a family tree, and you know, there's no brothers. We don't know how we all got here. There's no spunkles. There's nothing that, like that. But, so we're just all girls. Perfect family. And we have rules. So when I say we, I mean this group of people. We have rules. You never do a 12-step call alone. You will lose. I told the girl that on the phone today. I said, if you enter into the ring with this person, you will lose. There's no way around it. You go on a 12-step call, you will get drunk. You might not get drunk today, tomorrow, and you know what? There might be some freak miracle where you don't get drunk, but you know what? As far as I'm concerned, I'm not going on a 12-step call because there's a chance I could get drunk, so I just make that as black and white as I possibly can. You go on a 12-step call, I will yell at you, scream at you, probably hit you a couple of times, smack you around. Like, what are you thinking? A drunk is so much more powerful than a sober drunk. I don't know why. The power is alluring. It's very dangerous. If experience has shown that it is possible for somebody who is sober to drink when with a drunk, why would you even chance it? I don't care what kind of mood you're in. I don't care what kind of connection you got with God. You take somebody with you, because it's just dangerous. And so we don't screw around about that. We don't talk to drunks. Sober up. We will stay with you to help you through the sobering process or whatever. We will help you get into a detox if that's what you choose to do. If you want help, whatever it is, we'll try to give it to you, but I'm not going to start taking you through the book when you got, like, you know, boozy breath. It's something about it's not natural. It's, you know what I mean? It's like going into a Catholic church and start praying to Allah. It's something not right. So, you know, we don't take people that are drunk into the book. We don't talk to them about the book. We don't start telling them about what sobriety is like. You know what? Get off the sauce first, because you're not going to remember a damn thing I say tomorrow, and I'm going to have to repeat myself, and that's just annoying. So we stay away from that. And as far as the 12-step with newcomers is concerned, I do not hang out socially with my sponsees. until this or the book. It's too much. I don't care. I tell my sponsees when I start sponsoring them, I'm not your friend. I'm not your banker. I'm not your landlord. I'm not your pal. I'm not your cab. I'm not, you know what I mean? I'm your sponsor. I take you through the 12 steps. If you want to have a messed up life like me, then you can, you know, look at my bank account. You can try to mess it up as bad as I do, but I doubt it's possible. I'm your sponsor. The only thing I can give you is my experience with the 12 steps. You're on your own for the rest. Get rides to meetings. Get a support group. Do what you got to do. You know, I have had newcomers stay in my house. We've had our rent and cash stolen. I had a drunk person show up on my porch and try to get himself hit by a car in a road where the speed limit was 25. I've had scenes at my house. I mean, it's just like, you know, I think the most of us was 6 or 7 all at once. And, you know, if you got to do it and you need the experience, knock yourself out. But if you don't need the experience, stay away. Do not play with newcomers. They don't know. And if there's any newcomers in the room and I'm insulting you, oh well. This is my experience with newcomers. Newcomers are the greatest gifts in your life because they're going to make you work, and they're going to make you practice everything that you're making them do. We have a rule in our line of sponsorship that if I tell you to do it, I got to do it. I usually try to get away with not doing it, but inevitably I get called out on it every time. Sponsorship has definitely been a trip. I have a sponsee right now. She has her first two sponsees. She got them both at once. She's got the angel and the devil. I feel so sorry for this. I would feel so sorry for this girl, except I was her sponsor when she was new. And I wanted to fire her so bad. If my sponsor said I could fire her, she was so gone, she was out of here. And I tell her that all the time on the phone, and I laugh at her now. I'm like, yep, you reap what you sow. You reap what you sow. So she's got these two sponsees, and like she's got the angel over here going to 7 meetings a week, calling her every night, checking in, staying out of relationships. I'm like, watch out for them. They're worse. And then she's got this one over here. This is just a trip and a half. I don't want to call you my sponsor. Yeah, and I'm really not into taking direction. She calls me. She's like, what? What do I do with this? I'm like, ask God to get involved. It's between you and the sponsee. That's another rule that we have. My sponsor will never make a call on one of me, on a relationship between me and a sponsee. The relationship between a sponsor and a sponsee includes 3 people. You, the sponsee, and God. You can get advice. You can get experience from whoever you want. I am not sponsored the same way my sisters are sponsored, and they're not sponsored the way that I'm sponsored, and we're all sponsored differently because it's between me, my sponsor, and God. It's between me, my sponsee, and God. And so I'm telling her, it's between you, your sponsee, and God. And she tells me, I hate you. Why can't I fire her? Because I couldn't fire you. So it's, you know, sponsorship is a great thing. I love taking people through the book, mostly because I like to hear myself talk. And inevitably, things trigger in my head. Every time I read through the book, something else triggers in my head. I'm like, wow. And then like, I can share these things with these people. And I'm watching these people. Like, I got to tell you, man, I've completed 2 people. 2 people I've actually gotten through all 164 pages. I've sponsored like 20. I don't know where they are. They haven't called me. I wonder if they will. I wonder if I'm still their sponsor. But I've watched 2 people successfully go through the book. I know for a fact, I experienced it myself. You go through the book, takes whatever. Some people go through it in a week. It usually takes me about 9 months to get somebody through the book completely. Sometimes it takes a year, depending on how many resentments you have on your 4th step and how many I have to listen to. But after you go through the book, we've experienced as a group and as a whole, we've not seen anybody not go through this. We call it the second year. It doesn't matter when you go through the book, whether you've got, you know, 6 months, whether you've got 5 years, whether you have 20 years, it doesn't matter. There's that second year after you go through the book, it sucks. It's like you're getting sober all over again. And basically what we equate it to is that in that second year, you have all this information. You have every if and or but in the book. You've got all the directions. You've got all of the musts. There are musts in the book. You don't want to do it? Get out. There's musts in the book. You get all the musts. You got all the rules. You got all the stuff. And now you're going to practice for a year. God is going to put all this stuff in your life to give you opportunities for growth. It sucks. It's the worst year I had. I went through my second year at 7 years. I wanted to drink. I was like, I don't want to deal with this. Why is God putting these lessons in my life? I'm really kind of tired of it. I feel like I don't want to do it anymore. And you make it through that second year, and that's a big part of the 12th step, because if you can make it through that year, you can make it through anything. God gives us opportunities to learn. God wants you to see a character defect that he really wants you to get rid of. He'll put somebody in your life to make you use it. You know what I mean? Don't ever pray for patience, that kind of thing. You pray for patience, he gives you an opportunity to practice them. I sat in traffic for like a year because of that. I didn't know. The good thing is that I have plenty of patience now for some people. But as far as like, you know, I carry the 12 steps with me everywhere I go. And this past year has been a real miracle where I've really stepped away from, and I think I've really started to internalize them to who I am. Because I don't have to consciously carry them everywhere I go anymore. I don't have to bring it up in a conversation. That's the third step. We're practicing. We're now practicing the third step. I'd like you all to know we are now actively practicing the third step. You know what I mean? It's just like, you know what? It comes with you. It becomes a part of who I am because I continually practice it. The reason I need to still go to meetings is because I really like to forget all those rules I like to follow and all that stuff and like no lying and my life is none of my business. And then I tell you, I stopped going to meetings for a little while and all of a sudden that's really not my first instinct. My first instinct for anything when I first got sober was to mess it up. Just mess it up as much as you can. Mess. And then give it to your sponsor to fix. Now my sponsor won't do that for me anymore. So now my first instinct, and I'm really, you know, I'm not being egotistical, but most of the time my first instinct is, how am I going to best stay away from chaos? And how am I best going to stay on God's path? I have experienced that when I am doing the next right thing, when I'm living this program, not spouting it to people, when I am just being sober at work when nobody knows I'm sober, my life does run smoothly. The issues, they come, they go. It's like I lost the brakes in the car and they're just flying by and I'm processing them and I'm adding them to my experience and I'm taking what I can and, you know, that's what I do. Not to say that in 5 years I'm not going to stop going to meetings. I could stop going to meetings tomorrow. I could drink next week. Okay, but probably not next week, but I could drink. Believe that a relapse starts 6 months before you pick up. So I don't want to screw around with that. I've worked way too hard for the life that I have. Do you know what I mean? I've got great stuff around me. I've got great stuff coming my way. I got a great family, and I'm a great person. And for the first time in my life, I don't want to self-sabotage that and take that away from me. I've worked too hard. And it's the 12 steps. It's the principles out of this book. There are instructions in the book, and when I start to follow them, apply them to my life runs smoothly. And I'm out of time, so I don't know why. I feel like I could jabber on about, you know, AA and how wonderful it is. My only thing that I do want to say, and it's from personal experience that I'm going through tonight, is that if you find something in AA that you don't like, seek it elsewhere. Seek it at another meeting, seek it in another person, but don't give up. AA is just as sick as the bars. We're not here because we're well. And I love that. We're not here because we're well. And remember that. And I need to remember that most tonight. That AA works. And the people screw it up. And it's because we're human. And I'm going to keep seeking out the people. And I'm going to seek out the meetings and the guidance that helps me better my life. And I refuse to get caught up in any other crap that anybody has to offer. Because I'm not here for that. I'm here to save my life and maybe help one other person. Thanks for letting me share.
Hi, I'm Stephanie. I'm still an alcoholic. This is the card that everyone, or I hope everyone signed it, because I was in charge of that, so. That Kathy made for you, and this is a little gift from the group for sharing your experience, and I'm sure it helped everyone, because I know without that, I wouldn't probably be sober today. So, yeah, this is like the greatest thing that I've ever seen in my entire life. Okay. For many of us, our defects are like a spotlight. And then it says, Beth Beaver, who's close to you? Should I read the inside or is it? Okay. But by your sharing, we learned that we can get that spotlight down to a flashlight or less by working the steps of this program to a spiritual awakening. Thank you for carrying this message to us the last 3 weeks. Thanks, guys.
This is so awesome.